Tonight we're on the 112th lesson in our studies in John. We have proceeded, I think, okay through this 18th chapter thus far. We did a little different last week when I bounced around a little bit from left instead of going left to right through 18. We kind of jumped a little bit, and the reason we did that was to complete the Peter story at the fire. I didn't want to break up that moment. I wanted you to see that in its entirety. Peter warming his hands by that charcoal fire. Peter hearing the rooster crow. And then we even jumped ahead into 21. We didn't do a lot there, but just enough for you to know that the story ends good. It ends well. Jesus gives him a chance to be redeemed by another charcoal fire. So we got that out of the way. I tell you that up front tonight because we're going to skip some verses this evening. And it's not because they're not important. It's because we've already covered them. So we'll skip two passages. Well, actually, we'll skip one. But the text skips too. We've already sort of done the work at the beginning on the other one. And I want to talk about the doctrine of Jesus as my subtitle for this lesson tonight. And just to make sure that we understand that the doctrine, and I don't want to go too far into the weeds here, but I do want to at least bring this up. And I don't think it's anything we haven't thought about or talked about before, but the doctrine of Jesus, should be considered foundational to our understanding of what it means to be Christ followers. Okay? I didn't say Christians. The reason I didn't say Christians is because he wasn't founding a religion. Jesus never gives this indication that he's starting something new called Christianity. The Christianity that we know has as its real fulcrum the teachings of Paul, okay, and the Apostle Paul. And what Paul gives us from, say, Romans through most of the body of the New Testament constitutes what most of us know about baptism, what most of us know about communion, what most of us know about the indwelling spirit, what most of us know about justification. We don't get, say, justification teachings from Jesus. We don't get internal righteousness teachings from Jesus. We get a lot of things from Jesus, but we don't get some of the things we consider core to Christian thought. I'm not an apostle of Paul. I'm not a disciple of Peter. Neither are you. You're a disciple of Jesus. You're a disciple of Christ. So while we're Christians and we take what Paul says and we run with it because it gives us our greatest insight through the lens of the Spirit to understand Christianity, that's not the same as talking about the doctrine of Jesus. And I want to make that point very clear, because when Jesus goes to the cross, he doesn't go to the cross because he espouses the doctrines that you and I talk about in Christianity. A lot of those are Pauline. They won't come till after Pentecost. He goes to the cross because of the doctrine he presents, which is not a Pauline doctrine. And I want to dig into that a little bit, because the gospel makes it relatively clear that because of what he did, what he said, he dies. He faces the capital punishment of the Roman Empire. So we can live in the gospels and see that doctrine. And then we can watch how much it permeates the Pauline, Peter, John, James version of Christianity that we get in the New Testament. And I want to be up front. I know I'm kind of going slow through this. I just want to make sure we get this right, or that I say it correctly. I'm not downing Paul, Peter, James, John. I'm not downing Christian thought. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to show you that there was a doctrine Jesus espoused when he was on the earth that ends up putting him on the cross. And I think it would be to our value to dig into that doctrine, because we're disciples of a man named Jesus. We're disciples of how he lived. We're disciples of who he was. And that's decidedly important when it comes to who we are. All right? So let's think about this, first of all, based upon the trial. Here's a big, long paragraph to just try to get us on the right foot tonight. The most important trial in human history. And I know that's saying a lot, but come on, it's Jesus is going to die on the cross. I couldn't think of one that I think is more important to the flow of time than Jesus in his trial. So I call it the most important trial in human history. Has at least 7 historical witness accounts, which would make it as solid as any event in the life and ministry of Jesus. 4 gospel accounts, that's Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. There's also an apocryphal gospel, what is often referred to as the Gospel of Peter. This is about a circa 50-ish AD document that was left out of the canon. So it's non-canonical, is what a lot of scholars will call it. It's also apocryphal, seeing as it's not part of the canon, thus it's not considered endorsed by the Spirit. That doesn't mean it's not valuable, okay? And in this case, it's a fourth witness. And then two historians, neither of whom are connected to the New Testament, Josephus and Tacitus. Josephus is a Jew who writes the most important document for the Christian faith outside of the New Testament, if you want to understand what happens at AD 70, because he's a Jew who becomes a Roman, taken prisoner by the Roman army, and then writes a history of his own people from about 30 BC through at least 70 AD and then on. And then Tacitus is a Roman historian. He has nothing to do with the New Testament. He's not a Christian. He's not a Jew. And he lives right about 100 AD. He writes his Roman histories. And he's the Roman outside source of a man named Jesus, or historical source, rather, of a man named Jesus. And so when you hear people who say, oh, you can't trust there was a real guy named Jesus, of course you Christians believe that. You have four books where he appears in, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're all written by Christians. That's not true. It's an argument that has no legs. If you had nothing but Tacitus, you would have at least one eyewitness account in the first century who had nothing to do with Christianity or Judaism. You have more. Here's a fact, by the way, for you. I'm not up here trying to do apologetics, but it happens. You have more written historical evidence that a man named Jesus existed than you do that a man named Aristotle existed. And that is a historical, literary fact. So you have more reason to believe in a man named Jesus than you do in Aristotle. And Aristotelian thought is probably the most important contribution of Greek culture to the Western world. And so this trial is pretty big, and it's spoken of outside of the Bible. And so I think it's pretty important to take a look at it. Jesus, universally, and when I say universally, I mean in all seven accounts, Jesus faces Pilate. He does not face all of the same Jewish bodies in all seven accounts. Okay, they're kind of all over the map. Sanhedrin, Caiaphas, Annas, none at all. But every one of them Pilate. Probably because it's going to take that Roman procurator to actually commit Jesus to death. And so they all bring up Pilate. Only the Romans can inflict capital punishment. And that's really only a truth right around the time of Jesus. Somewhere, I didn't say that right. That's only a truth up until around the time of Jesus. Somewhere after Jesus, we get evidence that Jews in Palestine start to get a little more of their own individual governmental liberties and can inflict their own versions of capital punishment. Stephen is stoned to death in Acts 8. And James is killed in the book of Acts as well. Neither are killed by the Romans. They are both killed by Jewish leaders. And so sometime within the generation after Jesus, Judaism sort of flexes a little bit in the Roman Empire. Rome sort of gives them a little bit of self-autonomy. That self-autonomy leads to disaster, by the way. Because within a generation, the Romans end up invading Jerusalem and ransacking the temple. So some of that flexing of their own muscle ends up costing them. But at this point, only they can inflict capital punishment. Jewish involvement in the trial varies between accounts. We talked about that a moment ago. But what is certain is there was no, and this is the sad part, there's no concentrated effort on the part of Israel to save one of their own. Not one moment do we see them take a stand for Jesus. Even those who really could have done something to defend him, there is not a single instance in any of those seven accounts that anyone came to the rescue of their own, which is odd. Almost in any culture, someone stands up for their own. They either stand up for their own kind, they stand up for their own race, they stand up for someone in their own country, someone in their city, and yet there's no evidence that anyone stood for Jesus in this account. Let's read our first segment tonight from John 18. Jesus actually goes before the high priest in verses 12, 13, 14. Then we break away to Peter at the fire in 15 to 18. And I pick you up in 19 tonight. And this is a passage we did not read last week. The high priest asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, "I spoke openly to the world." I'm not going to spend a lot of time on 20 through 24. We're going to spend some time on 19 tonight. I'm not going to come back to it next week either. So I want to work through it just a little bit, and then we'll kind of leave it, because there's not a lot here that I really want to dig into. I just want you to see the conversation. Jesus answered, "I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet. In secret, I've said nothing. We can't take this to mean Jesus never said anything in private. But what we can take it to mean is that Jesus believed that whatever he said that caused him to be arrested, he had always said it in public. He's stating what he considers the obvious. I haven't led any sort of insurrection from a place of privacy. I haven't called these clandestine meetings and set up rebellions and overthrows. Whatever I've said that you've heard me say, I said it openly. I said it to your face. I said it in public. I said it repeatedly. And so I don't stretch this to say Jesus never said anything in private he didn't say in public. We know that's not true. In fact, Jesus will tell parables. He'll go into private and his disciples will go, can you explain the parable? And Jesus will expound on it and say things he didn't say in public. So it's not a contradiction by Jesus. It's an understanding, I think, by any literary audience that what he means is he's not establishing anything in private that gets him into trouble. He's not causing some insurrection. He's not saying things behind closed doors. I've been very upfront with what I've said. Wherever the Jews meet, that's where I've always said it. And in secret, I don't say anything. So that leads us to 21. Why do you ask me? Ask those who've heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said. And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, do you answer the high priest like that? This is the first evidence in the trial, and this is the first of many where Jesus is physically assaulted in any way. And this is the first time we've seen this in his entire life. Did he get in a boyhood scrape? I don't know. If he's like most boys, yep, he probably did. We don't have evidence of it. What we do see is in this moment, Jesus faces his first real physical confrontation. And it's all because he speaks so boldly to the high priest. We're most likely in the home of Annas, or also sometimes known as Ananias, the high priest, also father-in-law of Caiaphas. Although Annas and Caiaphas probably live in the same house, maybe on different sides of the house, but it was not uncommon for extended family to share the same roof. Something a little different in Western culture, but was not uncommon then. Whole generations, multiple generations living under the same roof. And so when he goes to one, he's probably going to the other. So he strikes him with the palm of his hand. You going to answer the high priest like that? 23:24, Jesus answered and said, if I spoke evil, then bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me? And it's a pretty straightforward statement. If it's been evil, bring up to me what was evil about it. And then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And it's worth noting, but not worth staying on for long. I brought this up last week. This is the only spot in the Gospels where Jesus goes to Annas, the father-in-law. The other Gospels ignore that. They don't have Jesus go into his home. Not a lot happens in this confrontation other than this is the first physical confrontation that Jesus faces when he's in this. But really, the heartbeat of this for me tonight is right here. It's the first verse we read. John 18:19. Remember, this was the first thing that happened in our story. The high priest asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Twofold question. I don't deal too much with the disciples issue. It's probably who's following you and why. Why'd you pick these guys? We don't know the answer to that question. Jesus doesn't elaborate. He doesn't go into it. The disciples were not all men. I know we like to confine them to 12. For purposes of government under the new covenant, 12 is a good number because 12 was a Jewish number for government. But they were not all men, not all the people who followed Jesus. They were a mixture of all different incomes and classes and races that followed Jesus, and definitely both genders. We don't get much detail there. And I didn't do anything in this entire John series on really breaking down the disciples. Because John doesn't do a ton of it. And so I'm not going to change that tonight. But just keep in mind that the discipleship of Jesus goes way past 12 guys. Okay? So it goes into this large group of people who would have been followers of Jesus. But his doctrine, we do got some stuff on. Because if you've ever read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you're reading the doctrine of Jesus. Every time he opens his mouth, you're getting the doctrine of Jesus. You're getting an idea. You're getting to see what it is that Jesus believes. So I ask the question, what is Jesus' doctrine? And I want to bring up what I think is a pretty salient point. Christianity focuses primarily on the birth and the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, we have two major Christian holidays that we celebrate, Easter and Christmas. We celebrate his resurrection. We have Good Friday. So we kind of cluster the passion together. With crucifixion and resurrection. Basically, resurrection and birth. Even the Apostles' Creed says nothing of his life. But his life and his doctrine is what made him a threat, and we should wrestle with his doctrine. I've been thinking a lot about this for a few weeks. This idea that Christianity focuses, and we're coming up on one of those major holidays in the next couple of months. We focus on the birth. We focus on the resurrection. We pay marginal attention to the life of Jesus. And this to me is kind of interesting, and I'm going to wrestle some stuff out loud with you, okay? Paul doesn't talk a lot of, okay, not just Paul. The New Testament writers do not talk a lot about the birth of Jesus. They talk a lot about his resurrection. They don't give a lot of physical details of it. There's no indication of sort of celebrations around those two events. Paul's entire biography of Jesus in 13 or 14 epistles, his entire bio is found in Galatians. He was born of a woman in the fullness of time. He was born of a woman born under the law. That's his bio. He leaves his life alone. 1 Corinthians 6, he goes, we knew Christ Jesus according to the flesh. We don't know him that way any longer. So if you read only Paul, you don't get much of Jesus. You get a lot of Christ. In other words, you don't get much pre-crucified Jesus. In fact, Paul never directly quotes Jesus in his epistles. There is a quote in the book of Acts that Paul is said to say that is attributed to Jesus. Ironically, that quote's not in the Gospels. That's odd. Paul never quotes Jesus in his letters. He doesn't say, Jesus said this, Jesus said that. If he does, he says, I heard it directly from Jesus. Such as communion. I heard it directly from the Lord by revelation that on the night of his decease, he took bread and wine with his disciples. And so Paul has this version of the gospel that is he claims to receive as revelation straight from God. But when we talk about the doctrine of Jesus, we're talking about what Jesus said when he was on the earth. It's interesting that we get excited about his birth and we get excited about his death and resurrection. And I'm not saying we shouldn't. But we don't put near the emphasis on the stuff Jesus said. And that was actually one of the things that has prompted my series, my monthly series here on Silencing the Lamb. Because I'm kind of stunned at how sometimes we're quicker to quote Paul than we are Jesus. Because Paul is sort of the Christian founder as we know it. And yet here's our man, here's our guy, Jesus. And I think sometimes it's because Jesus is decidedly uncomfortable in some of the stuff he says. He's giving us instruction, ethic, principle, that's just frankly not all that fun sometimes. And I think that has colored the way we look at the doctrine of Jesus. But I want to wrestle some stuff out. So I felt overwhelmed when I sat down to do this next part. I was like, well, how do you parse out the doctrine of Jesus? My goodness, it's loaded. I mean, look how long we've been in John. Look how long we were at those chapters written in red. And I didn't feel like at any point I exhausted that stuff. I'd get done with a chapter, we'd do like 6 or 8 lessons on it, and I'd be like, gosh, we could have easily done 15 lessons. I could have done 3 lessons on that one sentence. You know, there was a lot of time, because just it's so jam-packed with this, with richness and fullness. And so I sat down today to try to bring this thing down to 2 or 3, because you just have bullet point the doctrines of Jesus. How do you do that? I don't know. I don't think I did a very good job, but I tried. I got it down to 3. I think that at least we can attribute to Jesus that might have put him on the cross. All right? So this isn't exhaustive. How can 3 be exhaustive? It can't. But think about these with me. 1. This one's really simple, but it holds a lot of, this has got some TNT in it. Jesus revealed the Father. Jesus' doctrine brought man into a relationship with the Yahweh of Israel in a way that the Old Testament didn't even try to do. Jesus introduces how to pray, our Father. Jesus introduces the He who will take up residence in you, way, truth, and life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Jesus introduces how, he says in John 17, I have shown them, given them your name. What name was that? Abba, Father. The doctrine of Jesus softens the edges of God so that he becomes Father. And it is not Jesus trying to change God. It is Jesus revealing God as we've never seen him through the lens of the Old Testament. So when you read the Old Testament, you study out Moses at Sinai, or you study the giving of the law, you study the journeys through the wilderness of Israel, you get a God. It hit me this week as I was doing the DDP. There's a passage in Psalms. I don't think this is aired yet, but man, I got really excited when I recorded it, where it says, where Psalm says, his anger is a moment, but his favor lasts for a lifetime. And has that aired that yet? Have I done that DDP? Okay, that's coming up. And it was such a fun one. And you go, this is like the two faces of God through an Old Testament lens. His anger is but for a moment, but his favor lasts forever. It's the frown and the smile, you know? It's the yin and the yang of the picture of God. It's that cohesiveness that, but in a time-bound world, it goes, the frown is temporary. It's always temporary if it's your dad. See that? It's almost like a prelude to that in the book of Psalms. You're not even in the new covenant, but you got this prelude of the frown's always temporary if it's your father, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Why? Your father never stops having favor on you. He might frown at you, but you know it's only temporary because he's your father. And so you get into the New Testament, you see that in Jesus. You see Father revealed. And why it is so dangerous for Father to be revealed is if you really get people to believe God is their Father, then people feel comfortable going directly to God. They don't have the hoops to jump through. They don't have the hills to climb to get to God. They have God coming to them. And so I think the doctrine of God as our Father is picked up by Paul, but is established first by Jesus. Paul will run with it. Paul will give us sonship. Paul will give us adoption as sons. But the right to call ourselves the sons and the children of God, that's a Jesus doctrine. And may we never forget it, because all of our potential in knowing him in family ways, in relational ways, comes through Jesus. Second, this is a Jesus doctrine. Jesus elevated the law as a formula for loving your neighbor as opposed to a measurement of holiness. The doctrine of Jesus took the Mosaic law. It took the Torah that he had been raised in, that he knew, that the world around him was saturated in. It pulled it out of the realm of personal performance. His great objections in this was the Pharisees, whom every time he encounters them, he has some sort of public confrontation with. And it's never that, it's usually based upon the grounds that these guys are telling you this, but they're not opening their hearts up to the poor. They're not opening their hearts up to the hurting. They are crossing the sea to make a proselyte, and it's twofold the child of hell they are. They're an open sepulcher. They're whitewashed tombs. In other words, they put on a show because they keep the law better than you do, but they don't love the widow, and they don't love the fatherless, and they don't love the stranger, and they put their boot on the neck of the unfortunate. And what Jesus doctrine is to take the codex of the law and show us not that we are a bunch of miserable failures. It's to show us that we were supposed to be loving, unlovable people. And that was the purpose of having law in the first place. When you take a look at, say, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, 7, Jesus is giving some pretty heavy stuff. Like, you've heard it said, but I say to you. You've heard this, but I say this. You've heard the law, but I say this. That's a Jesus doctrine. You got Moses? What's one of the most obvious ones? You've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That's in the law. That's Sinaitic covenant. That's Torah. But I say to you, turn the other cheek. So the Jesus doctrine, why turn the other cheek? I'm showing you that what God's heart was always to love your neighbor. He loves your enemies more than you can ever love your enemies. And I'm going to be here to show you how we're going to save them. And so Jesus is elevating the law to a place not just to break our spirit. I mean, I'm taking my time here because there's this idea that is pretty popular when we deal with stuff like the Sermon on the Mount. In grace circles, there's this idea that what Jesus was doing was trying to show you that you can't do this so he could break your spirit so then you would accept him as your Savior. And I've preached that. I've said that in, you know, 10 different ways. And while I get that, I understand it. I understand that you can't keep the law. I understand that you need to know you can't keep the law. That maybe if you knew you couldn't keep the law, you'd turn to Jesus as the redemption. But I don't think that's what Jesus set out to do at the Sermon on the Mount. I don't think Jesus looked at the audience in Israel and saw a bunch of good law keepers and said, ah, but you're not as good as you think you are. I'm here to show you you're not as good as you think you are. I think what Jesus is doing is establishing the fact that the law did not exist for you to keep it for personal holiness. The law existed so you wouldn't run over your neighbor, so you'd treat them as if they were a human being. And that Israel had missed that. And they truly believed that the law made them superior. And Jesus was saying, the law didn't make you superior. The law made you protect people so that you wouldn't think you were superior. So that you would take care of people you were pretty sure were inferior. So the Jesus doctrine is to elevate the law to its rightful place. Its rightful place is not the source of your righteousness. Its rightful place is that it protects its neighbor. And Jesus shows us that some of the... Now, this is a very crucial sentence or thought. Jesus shows his own generation that what they were doing to keep every jot and tittle of the law, to keep the law to its quote-unquote perfection, oftentimes did not share the heart of God because it emphasized right and wrong over good and evil. And so you could keep the law to quote-unquote perfection and be evil towards people. Because keeping the law to perfection was, don't do anything on the Sabbath. But Jesus says, what if your donkey gets stuck in a ditch on the Sabbath? You going to leave him until the next day, or are you going to go get him? Now, the Pharisees' correct answer would have been, you're going to leave him in the ditch. Jesus, his doctrine is different. His doctrine says, you wouldn't leave him in the ditch. That's the only donkey you have. What if he dies? If he dies because you left him in the ditch, then you don't even have a way to work on the next day. That's a stupid idea to leave him in the ditch. You go, yes, but the law demands that I leave him in the ditch. And Jesus' doctrine says, you misunderstood the law. I'm here to elevate the law to a place where you care for those you're supposed to care for. And you take care of what you're supposed to take care of. And so the Pharisees stand off in the shadows waiting to see if Jesus is going to heal a man on the Sabbath. And Jesus heals the man on the Sabbath. And when they confront Jesus about it, by Torah, they're right. But by good and evil, Jesus is good. He says, how could I not heal this? Isn't it good to heal this man on the Sabbath? And that's why I was doing a meeting recently and answered a question, because I had made a statement in the message and ended up having to answer it in a Q&A, that good and evil and right and wrong are not the same thing. And the Bible fights that battle more than once, both Jesus and into the epistles, that good and evil can't be legislated. Right and wrong can be legislated, but good and evil can't be legislated. What's good's good because it loves people and it cares for its fellow man. What's right and wrong might not always be exactly the same thing as what's good and evil. So Jesus' doctrine was not to trash the law, but to show us that we were supposed to be loving our neighbor. Here's another one, and this one is one that you've heard me say many, many times. Jesus, this is his doctrine. Jesus introduced an invisible kingdom. Jesus believed he was in it. Jesus said, it's here. He said, if I'm able to cast this out, then the finger of God's come upon you. Jesus introduced an invisible kingdom built on forgiveness, mercy, and nonviolence. I sat and tried to think about all the things I should have said the kingdom is built on and realized that technically you could keep saying a bunch of stuff that the kingdom is built on. But I tried to dwindle it down to the three that I think were the most evident. Jesus forgave his neighbor, no matter who they were, no condemnation. Jesus showed the mercy of the Father all the time. He said, I didn't come to be served, but to serve. He said, you don't know what spirit you're of. The Son of Man didn't come to destroy men's life. He came to save them. And nonviolence. You can't look at Jesus. We just watched him get slapped in the face tonight in the trial. And Jesus doesn't respond the way we would respond. And that's outside the realm of natural world, how Jesus responds to his enemies. And so he's I don't really like the phrase invisible kingdom, but I used it because Jesus in no way believed that what he was introducing looked like Rome. He didn't think it was something you could see. In fact, Jesus said the kingdom doesn't come by observation. Doesn't come by looking at it. That's why I use the phrase invisible, though Jesus doesn't use that phrase. So understand, I'm just trying to get you to think in the terms of Jesus' doctrine included that which you could not see. And understand that from a Jewish point of view, the kingdom was something they highly anticipated. Okay? They've been talking about the kingdom all the way through the Old Testament. Kingdom, kingdom. But they believed that the kingdom sat at the end of the, at the end. And this is a big debate among scholars, and this is what causes some people to be sort of AD 70 or post 70 or futurist or whatever. You got to fall where you want to, where you think you should fall on that. But the argument among scholars is, did Jesus and the apostles think they were living at the end of the world? I contend they believed they knew they were living at the end of the age. And I think those are two different things. And I'm always shocked at really, really intelligent scholars that don't make a, that don't parse the difference between the age and the world. And it's caused a lot of scholars to be scholarly, but not faithful. And this is what causes a lot of people to make fun of professors and liberal college theology teachers. Not because they're not smart and don't know the word, but because they don't approach it from the aspect of a believer. And part of the reason they don't, I'm just giving you a little tip here. I'm giving you some insight. Part of the reason why, say, Ivy League theologians, and I'm not picking on Ivy, I'm just giving you an example. And that sort of theologian that's not sort of denominational Bible college theologian, but sort of secular Bible theologian. One of the reasons why they're professors but not believers is eschatology. In fact, it's the number one reason why they're professors but not believers. Is because they look at the statements of Jesus and the apostles and they say they all thought they were at the end of the world. And they weren't. And if they weren't, then they're good people, but you can't put faith in what they said. I mean, if they were wrong about living at the end of the world. And so when I talk about the kingdom, a lot of people, there's so many schools of thought on that, that sometimes I have to slow down, sort of articulate what I mean by that. Because in some circles, if you say Jesus believed he was living in the kingdom, some of your scholarly circles would go, yeah, and he was wrong. Because we're still here. And because all of those things weren't consummated that were supposed to be consummated. And so you really have to make this decision. I told you this because you're mature. You got to make this decision for yourself when you study the Bible. Because you're really going to end up with this. Either they were living at the end of an age. I don't care what Paul thought he was living in. Either he was living in the end of the age or he wasn't. But if he was living in the end of the age, then his statements speak towards the end of an age. But if you believe those prophecies are end of the world, then you've got to think all these people were wrong. I don't know where the middle ground would be. Or you got to believe what our dispensational friends have done for a long time. You put all kinds of stuff on pause, or you ignore the clock and drag all things out as if the clock doesn't matter. So you're allowed to say, we're in the end of the age, but that could last 10,000 years. Which makes your statement completely irrelevant to everyone if you were saying it in public. Hey guys, we're at the end of the age. You go, yeah, how long is that going to last? If you had asked Paul that, he'd have went, it's any day now. In fact, that's what Paul said. He's a thief in the night. Get ready. You don't know when it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And I've heard dispensationalists quote that and go, hey, Jesus is going to come like a thief in the night. I go, it doesn't work. You can't say Paul said that, plus you say that, and Paul thought he was living in the last days. So either Paul's nuts and he's not living in the last days, or the phrase last days has no meaning at all, because it could just be a last 10,000 years. So when I talk to you about the kingdom, I believe Jesus knew he had inaugurated the kingdom. John said it's on its way. Jesus comes along as the kingdom's here. You're not going to see it by observation. And yet there were things that were going to happen in that development. And that's the reason I told you all of that is because of where we're going to go in just a second. That happens at the trial of Jesus, okay? So kind of set you up for that. But there's one more, and it's not really a part of his doctrine. It's just an all of the above. All of the above pose a threat to the gatekeepers of religion, and they pose a threat to the iron fist of the empire. You want to know why Jesus goes to the cross? Because everything above that fourth one is a true threat to the Pharisaical high priest version of Judaism. Because if you can go straight to the Father, and the law is not about doing better so you can get more from God, and the kingdom is actually here, then you don't have to go through man, and you don't have to go through lambs, and you don't have to go through Torah. You might be able to go access God through calling him Father, through knowing him as Father. And so he's a threat. You can't allow this verse. This is going to sound weird, but I'm going to say it the way they would have said it. You can't allow this version of Judaism to exist, because that's what it would have been looked at. This is a crazy version of Judaism, and it's not allowed. And so Jesus becomes a threat for sure. So let me take you back to the text. Now, remember what I just told you about eschatology. I didn't really mean to get onto the kingdom as much as that, but I do know that I need to, because I know where I'm going. John 18:24 says, Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now notice this gap. So 25, 26, 27 is Peter standing by the fire and denying Christ. Remember last week we bounced back and forth? Okay, I skip it tonight because I want to show you what is kind of an incongruency in the text. Look at 24. Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas. 28, then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. So what happened? Now, you would swear if you were looking at this screen, you didn't have a hard copy, that we skipped the Caiaphas segment from verses 25 to 27, but we didn't. What we skipped in 25, 26, 27 is Peter denying the Lord and the rooster crowing. So this has been a source of this is a thorn in biblical literature. What's going on? Does John just skip the Caiaphas issue? My theory is that Caiaphas and Annas live in the same home. That's pretty much a standard thing. So the Caiaphas incident probably has already happened, and John's chronology is a little out of order, which is not unusual for John, if you've been following along in this series, for John to be chronologically out of order. But I also think that John knew the Caiaphas incident had been covered in such detail by the other gospel writers that maybe he skipped it. Remember, I think John was out to try to redeem Peter through the whole rooster crowing situation, so I think it was important to him to get back to that story. And he leaves out the Caiaphas incident. I don't want to leave out the Caiaphas incident because to me, it helps solidify the kingdom. So I want to show it to you from Matthew 26. Look at this. Now, I know we're not studying Matthew, but we're at a spot where we really need this because this is what's happening in our story. And I want to show you the Matthew version of it. Watch this narrative. Matthew 26, 59 to 68. The chief priests, the elders, all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at the last, two false witnesses came forward and said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. Jesus didn't actually say that. Not exactly like that. But he did say that that temple would come down and he would build a temple in 3 days. And John said he spoke this concerning his body. So, generally correct. The high priest rose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? The high priest here is Caiaphas, okay? 63. Jesus kept silent. Sometimes that's your best bet. And the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. All right, he's on the spot now. 64. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. The phrase it is not in the original Greek. As you said, nevertheless, I say to you, now watch this verse. Hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now this causes them to go into an absolute conniption fit. 65. The high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoke blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered and said, he's deserving of death. 67. They spat in his face, they beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hand. Here comes our second beating. So we get his first beating in the house of Annas earlier in John 18. Here comes the second beating. They spit on him, they strike him with the palms of their hands, and say, prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you? Now we'll get into the particulars of passion and the Passion Week and the coming weeks. But I want to show you that one verse. What was my next screen? Yeah, take you all the way back to 64. This is the one that causes them to go crazy. So I want to take a look at this for a second, because this is a very important kingdom verse. Jesus said to Caiaphas, "It is as you said, nevertheless." The word nevertheless, Greek, from this point on, right? From this point on, I say to you, hereafter, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Leave that there for just a second, Brian. I want you to kind of soak this in. Why does this make him so mad? The high priest loses his marbles over this one statement. Jesus says, from this point on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming in power in the clouds of heaven. Here's why this was such a big deal. I want to take you back into the Old Testament through a kingdom prophecy, all right? I want to show you what would have been very familiar to those who understood the Torah and who understood the law and the prophets. There was an anticipated moment that was coming in the chronological history of Israel. They were not there yet, but it was on its way. An anticipated moment in which the Ancient of Days would hand a kingdom to the Son of Man. That moment was the most highly anticipated moment on the Jewish calendar. You could not mark it by holy days. No one knew when it was going to happen. But they believed it would be the consummation of all things. Maybe they thought it was the end of the world. I certainly think they thought it was the end of the world as they knew it. And I think that's still legit when you talk to people about the end of days. That's why when people say to me, "Do you think this is the end of the world?" My response oftentimes is, "It's the end of the world as you know it. And so get ready. Because things aren't always going to be the same." And that's not just an REM song and a really good one. But it's also maybe a spiritual truth. So here's what they would have known based on what Jesus said. Let me take you back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 7. And watch this concerning the Ancient of Days. Verse 9. "I watched till thrones were put in place. The Ancient of Days was seated." Ancient of Days is a Daniel era statement for the Creator God. This is the God of the heavens and the earth. "The Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame. Its wheels were a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him." If you've ever read the first four or five chapters of the book of Revelation, this looks eerily familiar. That's because Revelation is building on Old Testament themes, signals, symbols, and motifs. The book of Revelation is not just throwing out all these fantastic things that John saw in the future he didn't understand. It's throwing out the exact imagery they did understand so that they would make the correlations they were supposed to make. "It came forth, a fiery stream issued from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him." That's a big old Jewish way of saying you can't number how many people were there. You'll see stuff like this resurface in Revelation as well. "The court was seated and the books were opened." Now watch this. Verse 13. "I was watching in the night visions and behold, one like the Son of Man." And there's the Old Testament introduction to the Son of Man. And watch what the Son of Man is going to do. He comes with the clouds of heaven. He comes to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him near before him. And to him, to the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. And his kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. What did Jesus say to Caiaphas? "From now on, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds at the right hand of the Father, coming in power upon the clouds." Son of Man coming on the clouds. The right hand would be he who sits with the authority, the one who's been given dominion and glory and a kingdom. Look what Hebrews says about Jesus. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. "He's the brightness of the glory of God, the express image of God's person. He upholds all things by the word of his power. And when he himself had purged our sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high." So the New Testament understanding of Jesus is he did the work and he sat down at the right hand. And in Jesus' words to Caiaphas, he says, "The Son of Man's going to ride on the clouds." Caiaphas would have got the image. He would have known exactly what Jesus was saying. There's the Ancient of Days and there's the Son of Man. And from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man riding on the clouds, coming in the power of the kingdom. Jesus' prophecy was not, "Watch the eastern skies for Jesus to come riding on a horse and split the heavens and come back and get you." Jesus' prophecy was straight to Caiaphas. From this point on, That which you've been waiting for is going to show up. It's going to start to manifest over and over. I'm going to sit down at the right hand of the Ancient of Days. The kingdom of dominion and power and authority is going to be given to me. And Caiaphas loses his marbles, shreds his high priest garments, and says, do we need anything else? That's the blasphemy we've been waiting on. You want to know what the doctrine of Jesus was? Not only is he my father, not only is the law so you'll take care of your neighbor, this is what gets him killed. I got a kingdom. I got it directly from God. When I'm done with this, I'm going to sit down at his right hand. And every time you open your eyes, you're going to see the clouds coming your way. And Caiaphas went, that's it, I'm done. This guy's got to die. The doctrine of Jesus, if we want to present the doctrine of Jesus in the manner that Jesus presented it, we need to realize we are citizens of a kingdom that transcends everything in this world. And while we may not see the full consummation of it today, we better believe we see it today. Because that's Jesus sitting on the clouds of God. Otherwise, quit acting like Jesus is sitting at the Father's right hand. There's some stuff Christians just need to stop deceiving themselves into if they're not going to believe they're in the kingdom. Stop claiming that Jesus is seated at the right hand of the majesties if you don't think you're in the kingdom. Because you can't sit down at the right hand of the Ancient of Days if you haven't been given the kingdom and ride in the clouds in Daniel 7. You don't get to have it both ways. You don't get to sit down at the right hand if you're not the king of the kingdom. You don't get to sit down at the right hand if you haven't received the kingdom and rode on the clouds and shown the old dimension, the old age that was coming to an end, that it was coming to an end. That's the first chapter of Revelation. They looked upon him, and those who pierced him can see him. It's an image that the kingdom of God has come and is permeating the world in which we live. And it's the message Paul keeps proclaiming over and over. Don't set your mind on things that are temporary. Set your mind on things that are eternal. Don't set your mind on the things that you can see. Set your mind on the things that you can't see. Because the form of this world's passing away. And he goes, this isn't it. This isn't what you get. This isn't the end of the game. And it's not just about going to heaven. It's about realizing that something has come to you. We need a revival of the doctrine of Jesus so that we truly believe he holds the authority. It's like I'm really excited about Sunday because I'm going to talk about the lion. Last month was the lamb, this month is the lion. And for those of you who have listened and paid attention, you know that the lion really is a lamb. But you can't ignore what it means to be the lion because it holds a real connotation. You just can't stop seeing him as a lamb because he functions from both seats. And what does that look like? And what's the reason for that? So that's the doctrine of Jesus. Let's bring this thing home. Man, I spent a lot more time on that than I thought I would. John 18, 28, they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. It's early in the morning, but they themselves did not go into the praetorium lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. I mean, they're killing the Lord of glory, but they're really freaked out about going into the praetorium because they don't want to go in and have conversation with an uncircumcised man inside of a house. Because if you do that, then you are unclean. It's amazing how religion picks its righteousnesses, isn't it? So they don't want to be defiled, so they're going to eat that Passover. Pilate then went out to them and said, what accusation you bring against this? Pilate has to go out to them because they won't come in. Pilate comes out and goes, what accusation you bring against this man? They answered and said to him, if he weren't an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. Pilate said to them, you take him and judge him according to your law. In other words, if he's doing evil in your eyes, then you just take him and judge him according to your law. You guys get out of here. I don't want anything to do with this guy. Why you wake me up in the middle of the night to deal with this guy? And the Jews said to him, and this is an important sentence, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. And I really want to land the plane with this tonight. This is a very important thing to John in his version of the gospel. This, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death, means we want you to kill him. How do the Romans kill him? Crucifixion. That's the mode of execution at that point in the Roman Empire. And so if the Jews kill him, they're going to stone him to death. If the Romans kill him, they're going to put him on a cross. And John interprets that to go, this is so signifying what death he would die. Now watch John. You've been through all these verses, but I want to bring them back to your memory. John 3:14, Jesus said this to Nicodemus. Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. What'd they do with the snake in the wilderness? They got bit by the snake. They put a brass serpent on a pole. They put it up in the air. Everybody that looks up on the curse, on the bronze serpent on the pole has the venom taken out of their body. Miraculously, Jesus said that same thing's got to happen to me. You got to lift me up. There's the cursed man on the pole. And if a man, and I got to be lifted up as the serpent was lifted up, that's a crucifixion motif. This is in John 8, 28. Jesus said to them, when you lift up the Son of Man, you're going to know that I'm the one and that I do nothing of myself, but as my Father taught me, I speak these things. That's John's second reference to when you lift. That's not lift me up in praise, by the way. Contextually, that's when you lift me up in death, you're going to realize that everything I said about my Father was true. That happens. John 12, 32, 33, one of the most famous ones. If I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all peoples, all men. Technically, get rid of that word. It's not there in the Greek. If I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all to myself. This he said, signifying what death he would die. The all that he drew was all the judgment. He draws it into himself rather than in some lamb. It goes into the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world. So there's three times, John 3, John 8, John 12, where John goes, if you lift him up, you lift up Jesus in the same manner in which you lifted up the serpent in the wilderness. And here might be the reason why for that. John's gospel emphasizes the lifting up more than the other gospels. In fact, it emphasizes it entirely. The other gospels don't make that big of a deal of the lifting up. Its late date of authorship, John's last for sure, could be a reason for John trying to frame the cross as a victory rather than a defeat. This is an extremely Pauline version of the gospel, by the way. Take the cross, which was a source of embarrassment, and flip it. Because you're supposed to be embarrassed if you're following a guy that died on a cross. Because the Romans don't kill their own. They only kill vagabonds and criminals. And your guy was blaspheming God and died as a curse from his own people? Come on, you can't follow him. So Paul makes it a mission in his writings to flip that script and take the cross from a place of defeat into a place of victory. I think John, and I told you this a long time ago when we started this, if you'll watch, Paul's ribbon runs through John. Here's another example of Paul's ribbon running through John. That whole lift up, lift up, lift up, that's very Pauline. Here's a couple moments in Paul's epistles. 1 Corinthians 1:18, Paul says this, the message of the cross is foolishness. That word in the Greek is literally the word for moronic. True, for the message of the cross is moronic to those who are perishing. But to those of us who are being saved, the cross is the power of God. Paul just leans into it and goes, look, if you don't believe in him, it's moronic to follow a guy who died on a cross. If you do believe in him, you believe you died there too. And that's Paul's version of Christianity. Jesus couldn't preach that. Jesus couldn't preach, when I die, you die. Nobody would have gotten that. There's no way you can interpret that without a resurrection and a Pentecost. So there's a lot of things. When I told you earlier, Jesus' doctrine is not exactly the same as Paul's. It's not that they're doing this. It's that in some ways, there's no way Jesus could present what Paul will present. Paul will come along and say, his death was your death. When he died, you died. So for those of you that don't believe in him, it's moronic to believe in a cross. For those of us do, that's the power of God. That's where we see it happen. Sneak down a little bit further in chapter 1, 21 to 24. Since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom didn't know God. It pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe in it. Jews want a sign, Greeks want wisdom, but we preach a Christ that's crucified. To the Jews, that's a stumbling block. To the Greeks, that's moronic. But to those who are called, both a Jew and a Greek, Christ is the power of God. Christ is the wisdom of God. There's Paul redeeming the cross. He needed one more because he needed to deal with that cursed aspect. He does to the Galatians. Chapter 3, verse 13. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. It's written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Paul pulls some Deuteronomy. He pulls his Torah and he lays it into that verse. That's the quote marks. That the blessing of Abraham might come upon the Gentiles in Christ Jesus, that we might receive the promise of the spirits of faith. Paul doesn't only redeem the cross as a place. Oh yeah, he was cursed. Let me show you what being cursed means. If he can be cursed for you, he can relieve you from the curse of the law, revert you back to the sons of Abraham, and you can be a son of Abraham simply by believing in Jesus. So this John move of lifting up Jesus is a very Pauline move. We'll close right here because this is where we're going to start next week. 1833, Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said, are you king of the Jews? What a good spot to start next week as we get busy with Pilate having his verbal confrontation with Jesus. It's a perfect, perfect place to kick off next week. And I know that we have at least another week and maybe more. One verse I wanted to give you, Jesus will say to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. And that's a good qualifier to the things we talked about tonight. It's because my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my disciples would fight. And so we'll jump into that. And Pilate's famous question now, what is truth? The great question asked in the Gospels. And John tries his best in this Gospel to answer it. A lot of ground tonight, covered a lot of stuff, hopefully good. just get us thinking about the doctrine of Jesus. Let's just say a prayer just to let this soak in a little bit. Let the Holy Spirit do some work in us as we discover together, through our walk, through our week, the doctrine of Jesus. Father, thank you. Thank you for another wonderful night in the Word, this exciting, wonderful adventure that you have us on, just mining out truth and enjoying this relationship you've given us. Thank you for the doctrine of your Son. As we sort of peel this onion back and find some of the stuff that we've forgotten about, that is such a Jesus doctrine that we get to call you Father. Not just call you Father, but know that we're sons. We get that because we watch your Son work. That we can see that whatever principles you put out through the voice of Jesus are so that we'll love our neighbors, so that we'll treat them with respect and dignity, so that we'll change the world through a means and a way that is nothing like the world, and that we are part of the kingdom. Help us to start to soak this stuff up and show us with the insight available only by the Spirit how this works in our life and how we can live this out. We thank you in Jesus' name.